Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 29th of August. We have a special announcement to start this show. This is something new for us. We have decided to do a Kathleen Dunn Show Goes Back to School. We go back to school every day on this program, but this will be a chance for us to get together one Wednesday each month. It will mostly be on the final Wednesday of the month, and I'll be hosting our Back to School Book Club. We are going to discuss an American classic, a book that directly affected or reflected our history, and many months we'll be joined by Russ Castronovo, professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is with us, the professor, to announce the first selection of our book club, and I hope you'll all join it. I think it should be just wonderful, because what a perfect way to have a book club. Professor Castronovo, hello, and thank you so much for joining us on this venture, and I will leave it to you to announce our first book. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Great, I'm really excited about what we're going to be doing for the next 10 months.
I am too.
Our first book is a book from 1776, and I'm sure many of your listeners know what it is just from the date alone, and it's Tom Paine's Common Sense. And it's a wonderful book because in it, Tom Paine writes at one point, the birthday of a new world is at hand.
Hmm.
And the question that I think we're going to want to think about, or one of the many questions we're going to want to think about, is if you're trying to start a new world, if you're trying to start a revolution or bring a new nation into being, how is the best way to accomplish that feat going to be achieved? Are you going to appeal to people's emotions, to their passions, or are you going to appeal to their rational side, their logic, their intellect? That's what Tom Paine is trying to figure out in Common Sense. How should I motivate the people of America? By appealing to heated passions or to cool intellect?
Hmm. And so what did he do, both or one or the other?
Well, I don't want to give away the ending. But there's a lot of talk of science in the book, but there's also some talk of, as Paine says, of cutting throats. and I think those issues for us, you know, how should we proceed in political debate, you know, coolly and rationally, or should we work from our passions and what interests us? You know, those issues continue to, you know, dog us today. They continue to animate the politics that we live with in the 21st century.
You're teaching Common Sense this semester as well, aren't you?
Yes, I lead off with it in my classes, and you know, one of the things that we try to think about is, does American literature begin with literature, or does it begin with propaganda? And that's, you know, Tom Paine's Common Sense is a wonderful piece of both, mm-hmm. of both literature and propaganda.
I would imagine that students respond to Thomas Paine. When we've done shows on Thomas Paine over the years, people just love talking about him.
Yeah, Thomas Paine was a real radical, so much so that by near the end of his life, all the founding fathers had basically disavowed any connection with him because he was seen to be too revolutionary, too uncompromising in his ideals. And I think it is that resolute nature of his politics, when he stuck to his ideals, when he believed in the virtues of civic republicanism throughout his life, that make him still attractive to us.
Mm-hmm. And tell our listeners a little bit about you, Professor Castronovo, what you teach and the kind of research work that you do.
Well, sadly, I'm nowhere near as exciting as Tom Paine.
But not yet, at least, huh?
Not yet. I teach courses on American literature and American democracy, and I've written a few books on the subject. And what I try to do in my classes is get students to think about the realm of the political by using literature. I believe that literature has this complexity and nuance that can help us, you know, approach the messy terrain of the political, not with a blunt instrument, but with a sort of a finely calculated surgical tool where we can try to figure out the intricacies of things like freedom and liberty and democracy. And when we use those grand terms, what do we mean? Well, I think that, you know, our literary archive of people like Twain, Melville, Frederick Douglass, you know, help us figure those questions out.
Well, it's a perfect time. We're in the middle of yet another election season, so it's a great time to talk about this. Is this one of your favorite books to work with students?
It is, and students, as you say, really do respond. And I reread it about 10 years ago, and it really changed my life, not for anything that it says, not for any content, but really for the how of what it says, how Payne goes about communicating his message. And since then, I've been thinking a lot about, in my writing and in my teaching, how it is that we communicate points that are dear to us. How do we communicate a deeply held position? And I think that's what Payne's trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope your students will call in, too, on the day we have our book club.
Oh, I will have them do so.
Oh, good. It will be assigned.
No, but they're always eager to get extra credit.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Extra credit. Well, I want to thank you so much. You sound just as enthusiastic as we are about this, and we'll look forward to having you guide us through this, and we'll all be reading this. It's just I'm looking forward to it immensely.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you and your listeners in about a month.
Great. Thank you so much, Russ.
Thank you.
And our conversation on common sense, that's the first selection, Thomas Paine's Common Sense, at 10 o'clock on Wednesday, September 26th. We'll be talking to Russ then, and perhaps some of his students will call in if they're availing themselves of extra credit, a chance for us to read a book. We haven't done this in years and years, so I really hope you will go to a library and get a copy of Common Sense. Bookstores will have copies. Used bookstores will have copies of Common Sense, and we'll all talk about it on September 26th. Should be fun. All right, moving into our conversation this hour, and we're going to be speaking this hour with Professor Robert Zaretsky, who teaches courses in modern French and European history at the University of Houston. He is completing two books, A Life Worth Living, The Meaning of Albert Camus, and Boswell's Enlightenment. He is a frequent contributor to a number of publications, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, International Herald Tribune, Le Monde, The Chronicle of Higher Education, and an article that he wrote recently in The Chronicle caught our attention, looking at old syllabus with new ideas. Because he teaches history, he takes on the question of, we already know what happened, how do we concentrate on the story? He talks about putting together a syllabus, telling students what to read and when to read, what papers to write and when to hand them in, what subjects will be discussed, the role of that, why he approaches that with such fear and trepidation, and what he hopes, really, students will be able to walk away with once they've had a history class, that it's not cut and dry, that the story, the what-ifs of history may be just as important as knowing, more important than knowing what happened when. So we'll be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Robert Zaretsky, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. When we last heard about your progress on putting together a syllabus, it was news that probably isn't good for your administrators. You hadn't really gotten it done yet because it's a hard thing for you to do. Is it now finished?
You know, it's difficult to say because I'm speaking from a studio at the University of Houston. Well, I'm still in a state of noncompliance for one of my courses. In other words, I haven't yet. I have one class on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I have a seminar on Thursdays. My Tuesday-Thursday class, I have broadcast my syllabus. I handed it out yesterday in class. But my seminar is, I still haven't put it on the university website. So I may be carried out of here, you know, midway through the interview by a SWAT team. So if there's a sudden silence at my end, you'll understand why.
Oh, no, and we won't be able to rescue you. I'm sorry, but
there's
nothing we can do from this end. What about this this syllabus? Are students looking for a pretty clear pattern of, this is what we're going to read, this is what you need to do to get an A+ in my course, and they're more interested in the forms that they have to follow than in what happens once they're in the class in discussing the great issues of our time and our past?
I think in part it's that, Kathleen. It's complicated, as most things are. I think a number of students are simply looking for a table of contents, what they need to read, when they need to read it, how they ought to read it in order to get an A. Students are, by and large, rational agents. They're goal-directed, and their goals, especially in this day and age, are to get good grades, to graduate, and to get a job. And that job, more and more frequently, is not in the humanities, but it's in one of the professions. And so there are those students, and for those students, I think for nearly all students, they're only human. I would find the very same thing, I suspect, that the syllabus is some kind of promise. It has the nature of a contract. And they're told in the syllabus, these are the things that you need to do. If you do them, you'll be fine. And by the same token, the professor is telling the students, these are the things that I'll do. There won't be any surprises. There won't be any detours. There won't be any reefs or shoals that we'll be bumping up against. Sure. It's a change of metaphors rather than a contract. It's a train itinerary. Here are the stops. And this is where we'll be at 4:44 on Tuesday afternoon. And then station X, after station Y, will be there at 5:12, and then station Z, and that's the terminus. And the problem with that, of course, and in a way this is determined by my choice of metaphors, is the terminus itself, whereas history very often is, almost always, it's in the nature of getting there that really counts, and not where we've gotten. And we neglect to look out the windows. The landscape is always changing, even though it's the past.
Mm-hmm. You talk about and pay special attention to those stories or the telling of stories that you think have been particularly mesmerizing, or those stories that are worth our paying attention to. The sense that what took place need not have taken place. Either movies that have looked at this, that have just taken us totally into the time and ask ourselves the question, what actually happened, what could have happened to change the course of history, immersing ourselves in the story?
Well, there are historians, for example, with my colleague at Wisconsin, Russ, he's talking about the wonder of Tom Paine's Common Sense.
Mm-hmm.
Let's think of Tom Paine as a historical actor. Tom Paine finds himself in Paris, as Paris and France, along with it, is evolving from an earlier phase of the revolution to one that brings France and the world to the terror. And suddenly Tom Paine, as Russ mentioned, was always too extreme for an American audience, or becomes too extreme for an American audience. Quite suddenly in Paris, he's thought to be far too moderate, and his life is threatened in Paris by the rise of Robespierre, Saint-Just, and the terrorists. And this is something that Tom Paine simply didn't anticipate. And so the challenge for a historian or for a novelist is to bring that sense of shock, say, for example, to Tom Paine, to students today, that suddenly they're thrust into a world that nobody anticipated, that history was, in fact, chock full of potential and can go in so many different directions, and that it becomes inevitable only after it's happened. And the very best historians, I think of Richard Cobb, for example, an English historian who died about 20 years ago, a fabulous historian who dwelt on not the kings, the generals, the lead revolutionaries, but instead looked at the people. He was a social historian, but a social historian who had the flair of a novelist. And he makes it perfectly clear in his works that what did happen did not need to have happened. So, yeah, I think Richard Cobb would be one of the great models I would cite.
Well, isn't it also the role of the historian to look at events and learn something new so that our understanding of what happened in a certain situation can be challenged? And indeed, historians will take us in different directions.
Oh, you're absolutely right about that, Kathleen. But as I mentioned in the piece that I published in the Chronicle, this leaves students at times uneasy because they do think that history is nothing more than a series of established facts.
Right.
And we do have facts. For example, Common Sense was published in 1776. But as soon as we leave that fact and begin to understand the ways in which it was received by its American readership, or the ways in which Tom Paine was received when he left the States and went to the continent, things change dramatically. We've left the realm of nothing but the facts, thank you, ma'am, to the world of interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
And historians, if
mm-hmm.
they're worth their salt, are always involved in the act of interpretation. All history, by its very nature, is revisionist. And revisionism has, of course, a very bad odor right now because we equate it with what the French call negationism, which is, for example, the denial of horrific facts like the Holocaust. But revisionism is the heart, it's the soul of the historical profession. If we allow students if we allow them to hold on to this conceit that history is simply a string of facts and that there is no way in which they can be re-understood, reinterpreted, revised, we do them a great disservice. We do ourselves as a profession, as a guild, a great disservice. And perhaps most important, we do the past a terrific disservice.
Well, you would really end the whole history as a subject matter if you just did, these are the facts, ma'am and sir, because look at how many interpretations there have been on the dropping of the atomic bomb, the Civil War, the presidency of Abraham Lincoln. We're talking the Revolutionary War, World War II, the Vietnam War. We're talking thousands of interpretations of historic events, and those are fascinating.
You're right, Kathleen. They're fascinating, but they're also volatile. You mentioned the dropping of the atomic bomb. Well, I imagine you're aware of that terrific controversy at the Smithsonian.
Yes.
At the National Air and Space Museum back in the early 1990s when they attempted to stage an exhibit with the Enola Gay. And it led to this terrific collision between the curators and historians on one side and veterans organizations and the Republican Party on the other side, the veterans. And as a historian, we cannot not be empathetic to their position. They were horrified at the way in which the narrative of the good war and their memory of what they did during those 4 years was being transformed into a critical enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you had historians who were saying, well, you know, if you want to have the veterans feel good about themselves, then let's simply eliminate everything that we planned in doing this in this exhibit and make it commemorative. And so what we saw at the Smithsonian, we see it time and again, the United States and France, which is my specialty, in Germany, you name the country, it takes place. There are these repeated, these inevitable clashes between memory on the one hand and history on the other. Memory is, by its very nature, terrifically selective, and it involves a bonding of a community around those aspects to a particular past that they cherish, whereas history, by its very nature, and this is the original meaning in Greek, this is the meaning that Thucydides and that Herodotus gave to the word, it means inquiry, by which Herodotus and Thucydides meant a critical inquiry about the past. We look into the past the way that, for example, the pre-Socratics were looking into the world with a critical spirit. And that simply, at best, it coexists uneasily with the commemorative drive of most citizens, and the two are equally important. The great challenge is balancing them.
Well, you also have to look at how willing we are to think about things, too. I mean, have we become a nation that's kind of lazy about everything? So, for heaven's sake, we're looking at TV ads to inform our presidential selections. What are we looking at to inform our understanding of a war?
You're right. I don't know if we've become lazy. I'm an aging academic, and when in my more cynical moments with my students, with my own children, I just, with the back of my hand, I more or less tell myself, oh, they're just so lazy nowadays. But I don't know if it's laziness, Kathleen. I think sometimes it really, a better word is they're distracted. Mm. It comes as no revelation for me to speak about just the fragmentation of our media, something that previous generations, certainly not my generation, had to contend with. And so my students, my children, find themselves torn in so many different directions. And it becomes increasingly difficult for them, for me, for that matter, to put together and to hold on to a coherent narrative, either about our individual lives or about our life as a nation, or about the lives of communities with which we identify ourselves. And so, the challenges are terrific, and unfortunately, it's not my place to editorialize, but it seems that both political parties in our country are abetting that process.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and let me give everyone the phone number. Russ Castronovo is our guest. He's going to be guiding us through our book club. Rob Zaretsky, I was reading different names here, professor of French history at the Honors College at the University of Houston, is our guest. And Rob wrote an interesting piece, which you may want to see. Maybe we should put it on our Facebook page, in the Chronicle of Higher Education, looking at an old syllabus with new ideas as students are receiving the syllabus for the courses they're taking, and particularly we're focusing on history classes. The writing, he says, of the syllabus has become an empty ritual of late summer, a thoughtless activity that has overtaken the practice it is meant to sustain. They tell the students what you ought to read, when you should read it. It's essentially a contract. If you do all of this, and then you're going to get a good grade, because that is important. And I'm told it is already on Facebook. So if you want to read it and then talk to us about this, if you look at history, it's very problematic to do this, because what you want to do is engage yourself in the whole realm of what it is that happened, the conflicting actors, the story of this, what we learn from this, how it informs other events, rather than looking at it as date, time, place. This prompts a larger discussion, too, of how we teach history, because I know many students are still learning history by dates, time, and place, and what a boring way that is to learn one of the most fascinating subjects there is. Won't you join us? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Salon Editor-at-Large Joan Walsh on her new book, What's the Matter with White People? It's a pretty good title, isn't it? Our guest this hour is Professor Rob Zaretsky, professor of French history at the Honors College at the University of Houston. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we start our calls with Dennis in Toma. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning to you all. I would just like to talk a little bit about how I put together my syllabus, and through the years, my syllabus turned out to be from about 2 pages to about 10, based upon how the students counteracted my syllabus. So what I did was, after introductions of the first day at the class, I would then appoint one person as a spokesperson for the class, and I said, okay, I'm going to go and get a cup of coffee. I'll be back in about 10 minutes. You will tell me how I'm going to grade you. And it was, the first time I did this, I thought, uh-oh, you know, but it turned out to be, I think, the best approach. Number one, the students bought into it because they were naming their own poison. And from that point, it was my job then to make it as interesting, and I taught economics. So it was my job to make it interesting as far, you know, put together my presentations, etc. So they would learn economics. And, my classes, you can either have tests, you can have presentations by group, by single, whatever. And it was phenomenal. I was really impressed. And each class thereafter, I learned from the previous class and made it even, I thought, made it far better. But the key was, is that the students bought into it. And I was amazed as to how many, we have to have tests. We would like to have it tests and presentations. I said, okay, what about written papers? I don't want to do that, So then what I would do is, okay, no written papers, but I will want you to write an essay every so often. Yeah, we can do that, And it was amazing.
Professor Zareski,
amazing.
What do you think of this?
Well, I have a question. Dennis, tell me, did you have veto power?
I didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. Did you have veto power over the decisions?
Oh, yes. I controlled what was going on without telling them I was controlling it. So they weren't, for an example, if they said, we want to have one test, I said, okay, how many questions? I said, realize that this test is going to cost a percentage of your grade. So think about it. And we would spend the rest of that class discussing how they were going to be graded. And it came out, for tests, I'd have three different tiers. I'd have one would be an easy question, one would be a moderate, and one would be a hard. And those three tiers would separate those just trying to get by, those that are trying to learn, and those that have an acute awareness of how economics works by reading chapters and discussion. And that would separate what I thought was my better students from my least, but they all learn. And I thought it worked out perfectly. Mm.
Well, that sounds terrific, but in a way, you were the invisible hand in this free market, weren't you? You were guiding the students.
Quietly as I could in the right direction as to what I really wanted.
Well, it's terrific. And this is something that I might try on Thursday. I don't know. It's terribly important, I agree with you, to have the students buy into the course. And the way that I've done that over the years, and I've been teaching now for nearly 25 years, is that I present myself as first among equals. And rather than lecturing at them, I try to engage them in a conversation. At times I structure it because that's what the class invites me to do. For example, the seminar that I'm teaching this semester is on Enlightenment thinkers. And so the way that I present it to my students is that this is going to be handled the way in which literary salons were done in the 18th century, namely that there will be certain themes or books that we will discuss on a weekly basis. You will have read them, and you will be expected to participate. And that participation, of course, requires that you've read and thought about those books. And my job, which was the job of the salonnières, those fantastic women who choreographed the salon, is simply to guide the conversation. Now, of course, my students, and I suspect your students, Dennis, were not French philosophes. They're starting from someplace slightly behind the philosophe. But it is terribly important to have them be active members of the class, either through the either through having them decide on the requirements as you have done in your career, or having them be part of the conversation, which is what I've done in my classes.
And thank you very much, Dennis, for the call. Let's go down a few years. You're teaching college students. Let's talk about elementary students or middle school students, and mm-hmm. you may want to reference your own children in this regard. Is it mm-hmm. indeed true that our first introduction to history is a look at, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue? It's that kind of learning of the dates, and this is what happened, and then we move on to this is what happened. Or is there an element of getting students absorbed in the storytelling and their own analysis of what happened early on?
Well, this is just based on my two children, and so I don't know how representative it is, but I have a 7-year-old and a 13-year-old, and my 13-year-old, his experience has been dismal. The textbooks that he's been using in his social studies classes, they aren't history classes, they're called social studies in Texas, have been written by committees. And of course, this is the case in nearly every state in the country. When a book is written by a committee, it's already going to miss a certain style that an individual author, only an individual author, can bring, if gifted, to a work of history. But even more important as a factor that influences the nature of the textbook is the fact that they have to be as careful as possible not to annoy or alienate any key constituency mm-hmm. In that state, in that region. And this has been especially the case in Texas. I don't want to go into the textbook wars that we've been having.
You've
here
had
over
them
the last
for quite
years.
A while, right?
We have. And of course, in some sense, as Texas goes, so goes the rest of the country, because we're such a populous state, and we do heavily influence the ways in which textbook publishers inflect their works, because the books that we're going to buy carry a great weight with the national market. And so Ruben comes home, I look at the textbook, and he is bored, he is abused, he doesn't know what to make of it. His teachers do use bullet points. They read directly off the screen, and they really adhere as closely as possible to these facts, these dates, these events, these names. And it's not a surprise that so many students, once they reach the university, once they come into the Honors College, and I should specify, Kathleen, that the Honors College is it's a liberal arts college within the University of Houston, and all of our students are scholarship students. And in fact, we have many excellent students from Wisconsin. And one of the courses that we teach in Honors is it's more or less a great books course. It's called The Human Situation, and we teach works of history. We'll do the Greek historians, the Roman historians, David Hume for the modern era, at times historians on the French Revolution. And more often than not, the response of these wonderfully bright students that I have is, oh, history, I hate it, it's so boring.
Oh, no.
Well, yes, and I think that to a large degree, our high schools and our intermediate schools are the villains. And not willingly, I think, in part, they're the villains because they become so gun-shy and so careful, so politic in the way that they address the past, that they're killing the patient that they had hoped to save.
Mm-hmm. So is there a movement afoot to change all of that? I know that there have been some great history books written for young people that really look at the stories and make the books very engaging. Is that happening in certain places? Is your profession leading an effort to really change this?
To be perfectly honest, I don't know what the American Historical Association is doing right now in order to reinvigorate social studies or the learning of history in our intermediate and high schools. Again, all I can do is base my response on what I've seen with my children. Mm-hmm. And so far, it hasn't happened in this part of Houston. But it may be happening elsewhere. It certainly is happening in the academy. I have the sense from many of my colleagues that there's a move away from this preoccupation with monographs, with bringing yet one more brick to the edifice of our historical knowledge about this or that event, and the growing recognition that if we're going to remain relevant, if we're going to have a role in American society as historians, as humanists, we have to speak to a broader audience, and we have to persuade this audience, our students, as well as the community in which we're situated, that history is meaningful, not just to us because we're paid to write about or to lecture on it, but to them as well. They just aren't aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think history professors are reluctant to have their classroom become a place of debate? Because if you look at history, as you were mentioning here, there are different interpretations of many things that happen, and you could engage in endless debate on the way certain events were conducted.
Oh, I can't speak for my colleagues, but I may be representative. On the one hand, I tell my students I want debate. I'll hand out primary sources to certain events, and I have them read those sources, and then we look at the way in which the secondary source we're reading interprets that, and then I ask the students to respond to that interpretation. And of course, there are debates, and I tell the students that, and of course, this is overly schematic. It needs to be qualified, but as long as they remain faithful to the documentary evidence, and that they handle it in good faith, there isn't a wrong interpretation. There are competing interpretations. But at the same time, to get back to the metaphor of the train schedule, you do have to move on. We do need to get to another station, even if it's not the station that's on the itinerary or on the syllabus. And, you know, a debate about the nature of the French Revolution, and its impact on French history, you know, we could debate that from now until the day I retire. But we have to move beyond that, just as the French have had to move beyond that. And there's also something very human, I think, on the part of professors. On the one hand, we tell our students to question authority. But on the other hand, we are figures of authority, and we really don't want to be questioned. at the end of the day, we would like our students to, you know, buy into our interpretation. It certainly makes our lives easier. But if we could remain as objective and as critical about ourselves as we should be about the events we're studying, we should always welcome and cultivate that sense of discussion and debate. Mm-hmm. This is what was done in the 18th century salon.
Mm-hmm. Tom in Ricetown, hi.
Hi, Kathleen, can you hear me?
Yes, Tom.
Okay, Professor, my son Michael is a beginning freshman there in your honors college there at Houston.
You're joking. And, Tom, what's his last name?
Mike Stratt.
What was that?
Okay.
Mike? Okay.
Wait, could you repeat that?
Oh, Tom.
He's breaking up.
You got to call us back, sir. We can't hear you. There goes the phone. This darn technology. All right. Let's welcome more phone calls. Please call us back, Tom. We want to hear what you have to say, but we can't. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm particularly interested in hearing from you, who those of you who have been in very exciting history classes. I love history. Most people who listen to public radio love history. And we love the stories. We love the discussion. We love the debate about how certain things happened and who guided them and whether or not they were right or they were wrong. And the debate goes on in a lot of these issues. How do you think it should be taught? What do you think as an entering student about the syllabus? Do you want a contract so this is what you need to study and you will be awarded a good grade as a result of this? Or is there too much emphasis on that? But how we take on history and the best way for us to teach history. Our guest this part of the show is Professor Rob Zaretsky. He's a professor of French history at the Honors College at the University of Houston. And he wrote a piece that's on our Facebook page that was in the Chronicle of Higher Education looking at this syllabus providing a false sense of security. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Rob Zaretsky, professor of French history at the Honors College at the University of Houston, is our guest. We're going to try Tom again. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I think I've got one steady bar here on the cell phone, so
all right.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Professor, anyway, I was just asking, I hope my son will have the opportunity to take a class from you. Do you teach all the honors students?
I do, but in fact, this year I'm not teaching human situation. I'm taking a break from it. So your son won't have me this year unless he takes an upper division course in the history department.
Well, I'll see if my wife and I can influence him to take one of your courses.
I'd love to have him. Thank you.
Thank you. Good.
Thanks for the call. I always like to hear stories of people's great classroom experiences. You become a professor of history. There must have been classrooms that you were in when you were, I don't know how old you were. Maybe it wasn't until you got to college. Maybe even when you graduated, you never had one. But just your idea of a great classroom, something that happened to you, that some history class you were in where you thought, this is the way I want it to be.
Well, it happened to me as an undergraduate. I went to McGill University in Montreal, and I was a philosophy major, and my BA is in philosophy, but I ended up taking many of my classes at the Divinity School at McGill, and one semester I took a class with Professor Douglas Hall, and it was called A History of Christian Thought. And to this very day, I have the most vivid of memories of Dr. Hall. Mm. Lecturing. He was of short stature, beard. He looked like a biblical prophet. And he had just quiet authority. But it was immense and it was present. And he didn't lecture, Kathleen. He would stride among the desks, think out loud, and then simply engage his students over the course of a semester. And I ended up taking yet other classes with Dr. Hall. And to be perfectly honest, when I think back to the course itself or the subsequent courses I took with Dr. Hall, it's not the content that I remember. And I hear this now from students. What I recall is his style, is his presence, is his posture, the fact that this was so terribly important for him. He was there. He was an actor in this life of the mind that was just extraordinary. And it was, in part, it was a show. He was a terrific performer, but he was performing what he thought was true and real and important. And to this very day, Dr. Hall is now in his mid-80s. He's retired, and we're still in touch. And I saw him 3 years ago when he was in Houston to give a series of lectures at a Lutheran church down here. And, he's a marvelous man. And I think it was Dr. Hall who, and the model that he provided, that eventually led me from philosophy to history as a graduate student. And, if there's anybody I could please with my work as a historian, as a teacher, as well as a writer, it would be Dr. Hall.
Oh, I love that story. I'm so glad that you told it. And I guess the other broad question is this life of the mind that you talk about. And I wonder how we instill that in our students. How do you, when you first meet your students, and particularly those who maybe don't have history as a major, they just need to take a course here, they're sort of interested, they want the syllabus, they want the A, they need the A because that's the way their mind works. How do you switch that to get them engaged in the material and more in a life of the mind? What's your responsibility as a teacher to do that?
Well, I think it is our responsibility as a teacher, but the way in which we try to carry out this responsibility, it's difficult. What I do, for example, in the Modern France class that I started teaching yesterday, I had the students read a piece that I had published about a month and a half ago in the LA Times for Bastille Day for their 14th of July celebrations. And I looked at the way in which the French understand the word liberty, which is a cognate with the American word liberté and liberty, and the ways in which the French understand it and the ways in which we as Americans understand it. And time and again, you come up with these, come up against these faux amis, these false friends. They're cognates, but they have very different meanings in the two countries. Republican, with a capital R here, with a small r in France. And so I asked them to go through the journals. I asked them to go online and to read the Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or the LA Times to look for pieces about France, to bring them in so that we can talk about them. And what I really want them to find in these news articles are things that don't make sense. You know, there's this wonderful phrase by the French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss. He said, just as there are things good to eat, there are things good to think. And those things that are good to think taste funny at first. You have to acquire a taste for them. And that's what learning is all about. And it applies not just to the field of anthropology, learning about other peoples who are contemporaneous with us, but it also applies to past peoples. And so what is good to think in France, say, in 1870, in the midst of the Franco-Prussian War? What's good to think in 1914 as the First World War is breaking out? Why are they so ornery? Why do they always seem as if they're trying to goad us, like in 2002 during the Iraq War? Are they doing it because they're malicious? Are they doing it because they're simply evil? Or are they doing it because there are historical reasons for behaving, for acting the way that they do? And we can still criticize it, condemn it, but first we need to understand it. And so I try to get them, you know, in part, they need to go to the media. But, you know, I guess I sound awfully old-fashioned, but they need to go to the reputable media, not to blogs, but they need to go to the giants, to those papers that they should be reading, I think.
Carla in La Crosse. We lost the connection with her. I'm sorry. Thanks for the call. Listen, if you served donuts in that class that you just described, everybody would sign up, right? You just made it sound so attractive. We could think great thoughts and eat great food, and life doesn't get much better than that.
Well, if I made it sound that attractive, I wouldn't even eat donuts, would I?
That's true. You probably wouldn't, but free food certainly always helps.
It does help, doesn't it?
So do you give students any – we have about a minute left. Do you give them leeway in terms of do you also write down, this is suggested reading? Would you like for your students to bring other things to the table that are not on that syllabus?
Oh, I ask them to bring their experiences to the table. I mean, what they read. I have in the past had suggested readings on my syllabi. This year I don't, in part because I've come to realize that the suggested readings are almost always ignored. They have enough to do with the required readings. But, you know, I do my very best to push, to prod, to have them think about things French from their perspective. How are things different? I mean, you know, we're often thought of as sister republics. We both come from a revolutionary tradition. How is it that we're so different? What happened? And did it have to be that way? And you know, I think the most important thing that I want them to hold on to is the fact that as these events were unfolding, nobody yet knew the ending.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Our guest is our Professor Rob Zaretsky. He's a professor of French history at the Honors College, University of Houston. The piece that he wrote that attracted our attention in the Chronicle of Higher Education, looking at an old syllabus with new ideas, is posted on our Facebook page. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And a reminder that we did, at the beginning of this hour, announce our Back to School Book Club, and it will be on September 26. So we're inviting you, requesting that you read Thomas Paine, and we will talk about it, Common Sense.